The natural world has its own sonic language, its own fingerprints. And that's one of the beautiful things, actually, about being out here. There is another acoustic environment, another sort of sonic fingerprint, and always changing. And every day is a sort of a different sound picture. I walk out the door and you do hear it changing over time. You know, the leaves are coming in now, different kinds of bird song. The wind sounds different. It's a wonderful thing to be around and to...
We tend to say humans and animals, but really we're all animals. Biology 101 teaches us that. And people tend to say, such and such an animal share this human trait. They're not human traits. They're all shared traits. Because of course, we all love our families or not. We all grieve if somebody we love disappears or dies, a family dog perhaps, a grandfather. We all feel loneliness. We all feel joy. We all really value our freedom. And so I think if anything, looking into the eyes of the animal, even online, you see a person in there. There's a someone in whatever the shape or the physical properties of that individual are. And that lesson is that I am you, you are me, only different. We are all the same in all the ways that count. Any living being teaches you, look into my eyes, and there you are.
These are the facts of our lives at the moment. And, you know, if we don't look after Mother Earth, Gaia, you know, she can't look after us. It's a shared experience. It's a balance between things, everything in life. You know, we need each other.
So I'm an explorer. I love the beauty of the world. I've seen fantastic things like the delta of the Ganges River in the Gulf of Bengali during a moonlight. I've seen the deserts with the dunes, with the rocks at the sunrise with my solar powered airplane. I've flown above oceans where there were whales jumping in the water and the big bunches of dolphins when I was flying with solar impulse. It's beautiful, but it's not enough to motivate people. And don't forget one thing. What we are damaging is not the beauty of nature. What is damaging is the quality of life of human beings on Earth. Because we can still have beautiful things to see. But if we have a climate change, if we have tropical disease in Europe, if we have heat waves, floods, droughts, millions of climate refugees, life will be miserable even if nature is still beautiful.
The living world is enormously enriching to human life. I think that was the first thing that I felt. I don't think I articulated it that way, but I just loved animals. I loved all the different things that he did, all the different ways they looked, how you can never know enough about them. They're always just totally fascinating. I think that was the first thing that I learned. And the only place in the universe where we have detected living things is this planet. Are there living things elsewhere among the billions and billions and billions of stars? Quite possibly, but life is at least extremely rare because everywhere people who've spent their careers looking for it, they have not found any. So we tend to take living for granted. I think that might be the biggest limitation of human intelligence, is to not understand with awe and reverence and love that we live in a miracle that we are part of, and that we have the ability to either nurture or destroy.
I was making a film in Amsterdam, and we just needed more footage of me underwater when I slid over the side of the boat and a whale started swimming up to me and didn't stop. And so I put my hand out to stop the whale, and it just put me right on its head and lifted me over under its chin and kept trying to tuck me under his pectoral fin. And I've been with these animals for 33 years. And so it was intriguing yet terrifying at the same time, because they are 50,000 pounds. And the big question was, as a scientist, why is this happened? I'm doing this. Only to find out about 7 minutes into the encounter when I finally could look away from the whale for a second and see a huge tiger shark coming towards me with its pectoral fins down and arching its body. And at first I thought, oh, it's so big, it has to be another whale. But no, it wasn't. It was a tiger shark and it was moving fast. So then I suddenly realized, oh, humpbacks have this altruistic behavior that I had read about. And I had seen a little bit of it happening with other marine mammals, but hadn't really known that it was going to happen with humans. And lo and behold, he just pushed me back to the boat. So it was a 10 and a half minute encounter. And he got me back safely, arched his body around me till I got up on the back of the boat. And it was shocking. I was so surprised. I think actually I was in a bit of a state of shock because I started laughing when I got on the boat. And then about 10 seconds later, I put my hands over my eyes and started sobbing. So it was one of those mixed emotions. Oh my God, I'm still alive. And I thought he was going to kill me by mistake, or maybe he wanted to kill me on purpose, on and on. And then all of a sudden, he just pushed me away from tiger shark for 10 and a half minutes. It's beyond comprehension.
And that's something that I would want all of the next generations to have in some way or another, to have the ability to access and be amazed by how staggeringly beautiful, complicated, awful in some ways, and just brutal the natural world is. But then really sit and think about how the natural world just gets on and does it. It doesn't need interference from us. It doesn't need us to design particular space. It just does it. And I look out the window and there's trees that are just doing their thing without any interference from us whatsoever. And they're doing it in such a beautifully connected and inclusive way that they're supporting each other and every species is benefiting from everybody else. And you could remove humans from that equation and nature would just carry on doing its thing. So that's what I would love for people to see and to realize, is that nature is so incredibly beautiful and diverse, and so are we. So how can we take the beauty and diversity of the natural world and actually learn a lot more and stop thinking we're separate from nature, because we are all part of that same biosphere on the planet.
Say tomorrow doesn't come. Say the moon becomes an icy pit. Say the sweet gum tree is petrified. Say the sun's a foul black tire fire. Say the owl's eyes are pinpricks. Say the raccoon's a hot tar stain. Say the shirt's plastic ditch litter. Say the kitchen's a cow's corpse. Say we never get to see it. Bright future, stuck like a bum star, never coming close, never dazzling. Say we never meet her, never him. Say we spend our last moments staring at each other, hands knotted together, clutching the dog, watching the sky burn. Say it doesn't matter. Say that would be enough. Say you'd still want this, us, alive, right here, feeling lucky. And so I always want to bring it back to, like, what is it to hold scary, frightening, overwhelmingly terrifying thoughts within us, but then also have some seed of hopefulness, some seed of acceptance and surrender to that there can be beauty, and maybe there's even more beauty now as we see it shifting and changing and maybe slipping away from us.
So footprints is about what traces are going to be left of us in the deep future, what material legacies we're going to leave to future generations. In my book, I don't really think about human extinction, not in any imminent sense. I don't think that's a realistic prospect any more than it has been since the invention of nuclear weapons. But that, I don't think, is the primary thing that need concern us right now. It's our effect on the living world. And I'm certainly aware that there's a kind of environmental writing that turns its gaze away from the difficult situation. But I think there's a place for wonder, nonetheless. I think we need that to motivate us, but I think that needs to be held in balance with a clear-eyed appreciation of quite where we are and what time it is, how late it is. It's a function of hope, I think, that we are honest with ourselves. For a long time, we've considered that nature is one of only two things. This has been said many times before. It's either a tap or a sink. It's a resource or it's waste. We need to get away from that. We need to get away from that reductive and instrumental extractive mentality. Part of doing that, I think, is adopting a much larger temporal perspective, thinking not just about our immediate needs or desires, thinking about the present of consumption, but thinking about how our actions play out over multiple generations. Who will have to live with the consequence of these decisions? So time is doing strange things, and I think we need to appreciate that as well, that our mechanistic, clock-based sense of time is not really serving us very well anymore. Our sense that time plays out equally everywhere. In fact, some people alive today have a lot less time available to them to adapt to the world to come than others. And that kind of injustice, I think, needs to be recognized. And to do that, we need to think differently about time.
We all are looking for a little magic in our lives, and I think that's what art and the creative process allows for, above all, is that in a world that can be either way too predictable and mundane and create tedium, the creative mind, for myself, is the curious mind, the mind that's always learning, and allowing yourself to make mistakes, but to generate from your core, from your soul, and from your experience, something new and experimental and something that is unique to yourself. And it's that it's like a daily gift you can give yourself, which is why I practice every day. And that's what the artistic and creative experience is for me. So in a world that's either so impossible to control, such as political situations and world hunger and gargantuan spiritual malaise, which is what I believe this world is suffering from, because we are way too identified with our animal nature and way too unidentified with our spiritual nature, which is what I believe is required as a transformation for this world to exist, is for us to become less selfish and more compassionate human beings, or we're doomed. You know, it can be painful to stay awake, or it can be revelation to become awake, which is why people are learning how to meditate and why that's coming into schools, because there's an awakening to yourself and to the goodness and possibility in this world.
So education is very important. If we think about the journey of humanity as a whole, what ultimately triggered this new era of sustained economic growth and enormous prosperity in the human population is precisely investment in human capital and education. Now, as we move into the future and we face new challenges, and one of them is the challenge about the environment, education becomes instrumental in assuring that individuals understand the science behind climate change and, in addition, understand the impact of each individual on environmental degradation.
And so you have pretty inadequate environment and climate literacy objectives and criteria that schools use, and not a single country in the world makes probably one of the most important skills you'll ever have, which is understanding the planet, a requirement to get out of high school. And so our campaign is focused on two levels. At the global level, we're focused on asking all the countries that are signatories to the climate agreement to agree to assessed compulsory environment and climate literacy education, as well as civic skill building.
The reason why I became a scientist is because of my deep love for the natural world and living in a country like Australia, which is absolutely extraordinary. We have more unique plants and animals than anywhere on the planet. And so growing up in a place like that really, I guess, infuses into your pores. I do move through these landscapes in a slightly different way to, say, other people who maybe don't have that training. But I guess it's my love of the natural world that keeps me going in this area. So I think it's fascinating, for example, that every single year trees can actually put down this growth ring, and that is responding to things like temperature and rainfall. So you can, as long as that tree's been alive, and some of these trees can grow up to 2,000 years, you can have this really long record of climate that extends back beyond the official weather records.
Let's picture 20, 30 years into the future. Imagine we really did become circular. Would we be embedding this into children's upbringing? How would we be changing our moral view, as well as the new mindsets and the new technology?
Well, first of all, maybe being a little more concerned about global warming, but it's a huge task ahead because there is too much of everything, actually. I remember when I was young, going to the supermarket, there was only some small groceries. You could buy maybe two or three types of yogurts. Now there is 300 types of yogurts. So the more we are producing and the more we are destroying the planet. And if you want to stay alive, we need to protect the planet. That's why Red Indian, they are calling it Mother Earth.
I was originally drawn to bees because they're social creatures. And as humans, I always wanted to know about ourselves and how we can be our healthiest selves and our healthiest society. Bees and wasps and all of these organisms have been around for so long. Bees especially have been around for 100 million years.
I guess the work that we're doing here at the Climate Hazard Center is trying to build out the science to cope with a 2-degree world. And I think that we can do that. It's not going to be easy, but I think that's definitely within our capabilities. And it is already making human beings be smarter together in very empowering ways.
But thinking about how our actions play out over multiple generations, who will have to live with the consequence of these decisions? So I think we need to stretch our sense of time. And within that, stretch our sense of empathy. We need a more elastic sense of empathy that can encompass not just those close to us or living alongside us, but those who have yet to be born.
Think of yourself as a tree. You've got neighbors that you live beside for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and none of you can move around. So you just have to communicate in other ways. And so trees have evolved to have these ways of communicating with each other. And they're sophisticated, they're nuanced. They include things like transmitting information through these root networks that link them together. They transmit information to each other through the air. So they perceive each other and they communicate and then they respond to each other. And that information, that language is complex. And we don't even understand the full language. But what we do know is that they communicate by sharing information, resources, how well they're doing, how stressed out they might be, how healthy they are, what their identity is, their species, whether they're related or not.
Something like 74 billion animals we raise and kill each year on this planet. And if we can't make inroads into that and change attitudes to that, then I have fears for where we're going.
It's so inspiring to be working with young people all around the world. And we are in the midst of transformational change. And that working together around these kind of key moments where you can see those shifts happening, that the unimaginable things that you never thought were going to happen can happen. So you need to think of this in your own resilience and not have despair if things don't go your way on a specific campaign or thing that you're trying, but know that it will come back. There will be another moment that you can have that win, that you can move things forward.
Living altruistically ought to be a part of our life, not the whole of our life. We don't expect people to be saints, but thinking about making the world a better place should be one of our objectives for everybody. And insofar as we do try to make the world a better place, we should use the resources that we can spare for that.
The Creative Process and One Planet podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
We hope you've enjoyed this program. To hear more from these guests, listen to their full interviews. These interviews were conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. This episode was produced by Mia Funk and Tom Logan. Additional production support by Katie Foster.
If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thank you for listening.